Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 1, Questions by Vidura, text number 40. Aho patapi jiyatera bhakate. Rajyari shibharyena vinavitena. Yastvika viro dirato vijighe. O dvitya akakubhas chattasra aho. My Lord, Prita Kunti api also Driyate bears her life. Arabaka ate, for the sake of fatherless children. Rajarishi, King Pandu, Varyena, the best. Vina api, without him. Tena, him. Ya, one who. Two, but. Eka, alone. Viraha, the warrior. Ariratha, commander. Vijighe, could conquer. Danu, the bow. Dvitiya, the second. Kakubaha, directions. Chatasra, four. Translation. O my Lord, is Prita still living? She lived only for the sake of her fatherless children. Otherwise, it was impossible for her to live without King Pandu, who was the greatest commander and who alone conquered the four directions simply with the help of a second bow. So we'll say responsibly. O my Lord, is Prita still living? She lived only for the sake of her fatherless children. Otherwise, it was impossible for her to live without King Pandu, who was the greatest commander and who alone conquered the four directions simply with the help of a second bow. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. A faithful wife cannot live without her lord, the husband, and therefore all widows used to voluntarily embrace the burning fire which consumed the dead husband. This system, it was very common in India because all the wives were chaste and faithful to their husbands. Later on, with the advent of the age of Kali, the wives gradually began to be less adherent to their husbands, and the voluntary embrace of the fire by the widows became a thing of the past. Very recently, the system was abolished, since the voluntary system had become a forceful social custom. When Maharaj Pandu died, both his wives, namely Kunti and Madri, were prepared to embrace the fire. But Madri requested Kunti to live for the sake of the younger children, the five Pandavas. This was agreed upon by Kunti at the added request of Vyasadeva. In spite of her bereavement, Kunti decided to live, not to enjoy life in the absence of her husband, but only to give protection to the children. This incident is referred to here by Vidura because he knew all the facts about his sister-in-law, Kunti Devi. It is understood that Maharaj Pandu was a great warrior and that he alone, with the help of bow and arrow, could conquer the world's four directions. In the absence of such a husband, it was almost impossible for Kunti to live on even as a widow, but she had to do it for the sake of the five children.
Opatapi jite rabakate rajri shivarina vinapitena yastwe kiviro dirato vijighe danodvitiya akubhas achatasaha.
Oh my lord, is Prita still living? She lived only for the sake of her fatherless children. Otherwise, it was impossible for her to live without King Pandu, who was the greatest commander and who alone conquered the four directions simply with the help of a second bow. So here we get a glimpse into the wonderful character of this generation who lived 5,000 years ago when Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was also with us on the planet. And of course, previous to that, the Vedic culture was also flourishing. And we see that this is the measure of civilization, that the measure of civilization was how a person was developing their character and their consciousness. And whereas in our modern day, with the progress of Kali, that means nothing. Character, you don't need to, there is not much importance played upon it. There's a general understanding that, it's good to be a good person, like that. But in this world, everyone knows that you'll basically just get further ahead if you have money. And if you are somewhat ruthless and cunning and, someone who can do all sorts of nonsense things undetected, here we see that Kunti Devi and Madri, they were, of course, these are very great personalities, exceptional personalities, but at the same time, they do represent, as Prabhupada puts here, a common state of consciousness amongst the women, is that their relationships with their husbands was very, very deep. It was a very powerful relationship and a very affectionate relationship. And if the husband happened to leave this world, prematurely, the wives would actually rather enter into fire and called the sati, right, I think they call it, rather than live, because the burning pain of living without their husband was more unbearable. Entering into fire was considered not such a difficult thing compared to living without their husband. So, you know, you can just imagine the depth of the relationships that were there. So both Madri and Kunti were both prepared to enter into the fire when Pandu died. So, and of course, this quality of chastity, being chaste, is, you know, right throughout the Vedic culture, from the Brahmanas, even down to the Sudras. They were very chaste, they were very dutiful, they were very responsible. Of course, nowadays when people consider having a marriage relationship, they like to sign the prenuptial agreement. A prenup, as they... It's not a prenuptial legal agreement anymore. It's just a prenup because it's so common. You know, we'll do a prenup. You know, like that. It's just because it's understood that there's more chance that the person you're marrying, you know, has so little attachment to you that they're likely to fleece you for every penny you've got and leave you, you know, crying for the rest of your life. And then they may taunt you even after that. So I'm not talking about women, I'm talking about men and women. They do it to each other. So, you know, there's no throwing flowers. So, and of course, you know, if you use words like duty, you know, people look at you in a strange way. You know, duty, what is that, you know? As some of these words, they're uncommon words. You know, people have no sense of duty, faithful in it, you know, being faithful to someone. You know, if someone is has they put their trust or faith in someone else, it's a sign of weakness in their own character these days. You know, that people are trained that. I mean, I'm just reflecting on some of the instructions my father gave me as well as I'm saying this. But, you know, you don't trust anyone. Look after yourself and never give a sucker an even break. You know, all these sort of, you know, if you rely on someone else, it means that, you know, you're somewhat useless or deficient in some department. It's not taken as a good quality. And in fact, you know, now, of course, the concept of a spiritual master is more prevalent around the world. Still, it's somewhat fashionable. People don't actually rely on the guru. It's a fashion. They accept, you know, did you hear that, you know, so-and-so's got a guru? You know, it's like everyone's talking about him. He's got this guru, you know. And, I think I'm going to get a guru like this. It's fashionable, yeah. You know. Like as Prabhupada says, you keep a dog, you know. So he says, in the West, you know, everyone keeps a dog. It's a fashion, you know, a dog or a cat, some pet. Around the world also, it's a fashion to, you know, keep a guru, you know. It has no real significance. That people are not actually going to depend upon that person or, you know, rely on that person. They're still looking after themselves and, you know, totally independent in their thoughts and their actions. They're basically going to do whatever they want. But still, these days it's not, you know, as unusual when here in ISKCON understand that it is an essential step to take a guru in order to advance in spiritual life. We understand that it's not possible actually to advance in spiritual life without accepting a spiritual guide. But people in general who may be accepting a guru as a fashion, so therefore they also have gurus, so they don't really see, you know, that there's we're doing anything unusual. In the earlier part of the movement, though, you know, the fashion of accepting a guru was not so prominent. People didn't have gurus. And therefore, you know, quite often when we spoke to people about Krishna consciousness, one of the biggest obstacles we had was the fact that we actually accepted a guru. You know, you don't see that as much these days, that people look, you know, step back and think, oh, you've got a guru, you know. It's like, what's going on there? You know? But it was a big obstacle. You know, when if you were trying to present Krishna consciousness to people who were coming to the programs and what have you, it would come up, you know, the guru. And it was a bad topic in one sense. You know, there was a few who accepted, but actually a lot of people, it was a real stumbling block. Like, so you do whatever that person says? Like, you know, he tells you how to live your life and, you know, so many things like this, you know. So they couldn't understand that at all. But of course, they don't understand what to speak of the guru, who is the very, highest manifestation of good qualities and good character and godliness that is possible. What to speak of understanding guru, you know, that their understanding of, you know, even a wife being chaste to her husband would be difficult for them to understand. You know, what to speak of a guru. You know, they fail to understand that, the guru is of such a calibre. So we sing that prayer, you know, Samsaradava, Naralila Loka, Janaya Karina, Gunaganatan, Patachi Kalina, Gunanavasya, Vande Guroshi, Charanaravindam. He's an ocean of transcendental qualities, an ocean of transcendental qualities. So that is very, very difficult for someone to, you know, understand the depth of character that is there. But even in the Vedic times, it's just very common that people had good character, you know, compared to now. In Vedic times, you know, the average sudra, if they were here now, they'd be a very glorious person. You know, that their character would be, people would look at them, they're like one in hundreds and hundreds of thousands, just, you know, their conscientiousness and they're willing to, assist and serve. They have that wonderful quality, you know, they love to serve those who are qualified. And, in this day and age, of course, you know, it's how to get out of work. You know, that's the, that's the trick, how to get out of work. But that, the sudras, they understood, it's wonderful. Get in and do a good day's work for those who are really qualified and very, very satisfied with those they're working for, the masters. Even though they perhaps, they had the all the facilities of life, but they weren't necessarily accumulating wealth or, you know, big palaces or so much, but they had everything they need to live a happy life and what have you. But still, they're very, very satisfied. Today, you know, of course, those who are, everyone is born sudra in Kali Yuga, but they don't have any of the good qualities that the sudras even had. And You know, that attitude of service is not there. You know, people are motivated by greed and lust and anger, and they procrastinate a lot. They're very, very resentful. I remember one time when I was at the when I was on the farm, we used to do the catering for some of the large concerts, and so we had a team. Wasn't quite a team. I used to get a few people from university programs and a couple of my younger daughters. There was one or two of the people from the Indian community here used to come and help. So we had about a dozen people. You know, they'd never really met each other. They'd never really done any service, most of them. You know, they didn't know anything about Krishna consciousness, but somehow, except for a couple of the devotees, gathered them all together. And but they had that sense that they were doing this for the Hare Krishna movement, which they had a lot of respect for. So, plus some of them got a free ticket into the concert. But they used to work, you know, 10, 12-hour day shifts. And, I used to give them a fair sort of a break. I'd get them to do something because I would think that, okay, if you cook now, people will come at this time and, we'll get some good profit. So then, you know, once they'd done all their work, I'd let them wander off and what have you. So they'd come back at a certain time. But they work really hard. And, the people from the other stalls used to come over and just watch. You know, just they were amazed to see children, you know, my sort of young teenage daughters, students who, they don't work a lot. Some do. No, they're forced to. But, they would come over and they'd just watch them and just work like this well-oiled machine. You know, just getting stuck into it hour after hour, you know, just pumping out thousands of bakoras and, you know, tons and tons of subji and what have you. They used to then, in the quiet time, they would complain about how they hated their boss and how he works them so hard. Even though they didn't work a fraction of what we were doing, they would come over and they would complain bitterly about their boss and their conditions and about their pay. At one time, there was one lady, she was saying to me, you know, she was telling me how much money she got from, doing the work. And, you know, and she said to me, "How much do you pay your workers?" I said, "Nothing." She said, "What?" I said, "Nothing. You know, they just like doing it." So, but people can't understand these things, you know, where there's some character, you're doing something out of a sense of love and devotion and sacrifice, giving everything you have fully, wholeheartedly, without any reservation, and you're not getting anything back. I always remember we used to do Sankirtan. You'd go out and you might spend a couple of weeks on the road. You'd come back to the temple. You'd work really hard. You'd put in a lot of austerities. You brought back a couple of few grand for the temple, Lakshmi points, and we knew that perhaps the spiritual master was coming. Sometimes there were marathons and you'd be working hard every day from morning till night. And you know what we were looking forward to? A cookie. You know, the guru would hold down, "Here's a cookie." That was it. So I remember one time I was in Perth and Ramaswamy was visiting, and it was the same time as the Guru was there, and the Guru put his hand out, you know, with a cookie, and I saw that cookie and I just jumped up. I just went charging up there, you know, and then I got there and my spiritual master looking at me, and you know, then I looked behind me. I saw Ramaswamy was coming in a slow second behind me for the cookie. And my spiritual master said, usually we let the sannyasis go first, you know, like this. And he said, but actually in this case, I like your eagerness, so I got the cookie anyway. But you know, we would, there was, because there's, this is something which people who accept a guru out of fashion cannot understand, is that you know, we have the pleasure of you know, doing service for Srila Prabhupada and his followers, and you know, it's such a wonderful opportunity that, you know, we think to ourselves, you know, I'll give you money. Let me, you know, I'll give you everything. Let me do some little service. And, you know, any little service, of course, because Srila Prabhupada has, you know, such wonderful qualities. You know, his devotion to his guru, to his spiritual master, his spiritual master asked him to go to the Western world and to, you know, in the Western English-speaking countries to spread Krishna consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, tried to do that. He had in his mind that if he, because he was doing business in his pharmaceutical business, that if he could gradually build up enough wealth, then that would be a good basis for him then to travel abroad and to, you know, have sufficient facilities to, you know, fulfill his spiritual master's order. But of course, gradually he learned that Krishna had a different idea. Krishna particularly wanted the world to see that actually you don't need anything else except your chastity to Krishna, your love for Krishna. That is sufficient. Krishna wanted to show, of course, then, you know, the difficulty is there, then you've got to find a devotee who has that chastity and love for Krishna, who can demonstrate that. And Srila Prabhupada did. He tried for his entire life to, you know, so he met his spiritual master, I think it was, that was 1922, initiated 1933, came to the West in 1965. It was about, what's that, 42 years. In that time, 42 years trying to fulfill that order, you'd think someone would give up after 42 years. You know, quite often, because I do a little astrology, sometimes people come to me that they've lost their job. And even some of the men, they're almost in tears. You know, I've been trying, like, for the last 2 weeks to get a job. You know, I'm just about pulling my hair out. I'm just about to give up. You know, it's like, what, you know, they become very despondent, you know, and sometimes, you know, give up trying, you know, even though they need the money to pay the rent. But, you know, 40-something years, Srila Prabhupada tried day in, day out. And of course, all his attempts in one sense, to start Krishna consciousness through creating business, you know, first, Krishna wasn't interested in that. He kept smashing, taking the rug out from under his feet. He understood that, you know, but because he was devoted to his spiritual master and to the teachings of Krishna consciousness, you know, he left India at the age of, I think he had his 70th birthday on the Jaladuta, and he crossed the ocean on the voyage. He had two heart attacks, which just about killed him. You would think that when you got to the other side, I mean, you can't turn a boat around the middle of the ocean, but you'd think when you got to the other side, you might spend a couple of weeks and just go back to India. You know, I'm out of my depth here. Struggled, you know, living in places like the Bowery and what have you, preaching to the walls. Srila Prabhupada, in the beginning, there was no one to preach to. He was sitting in his apartment. His spiritual master said to him, if there's no one to preach to, you preach to the walls. They will listen. And he recorded. As far as I understand, that some of that, you know, hearing and chanting he was doing there became the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita that we now read. But yeah, he wasn't sure that anyone would ever hear that, you know, whether, and of course he was in the Western world. People were absorbed in intoxication, eating meat, gambling, illicit sex, and his mission was to go and tell them, give up this intoxication, give up this meat eating. You know, there was there's a very famous cook, maybe he's infamous, but Jamie Oliver from Britain, and you know, he went to he's got the Ministry of Food or something, you know, because he's so famous that he thought he might as well make a Ministry of Food, and he went to America, and you know, he saw that. Because people are eating these unmentionable foods, all fatty, you know, we won't even say, but, you know, terrible foods, you know, and they were, you know, suffering their physical health. You know, there's a huge proportion of the people in Western countries who are obese and, you know, have a lot of physical problems because just being too overweight, especially with, you know, bad foods that clog up the whole system. So he was trying to tell them, you know, perhaps you could eat a little bit more healthy. And he gave them a few suggestions. And they became extremely angry. Who are you? You come over here from, you know, England telling us how to eat our food. Go back to your own country and take your ministry with you. Like this. So you imagine the task. You know, it's not an easy task. Even people are dying, they'll still eat that. Rather than someone tells them, that's what, as we say, people won't accept a guru really in any fashion. You know, anyone who gives any instruction, it's folly to be wise in a fool's paradise. In Kali Yuga, you know, if you give instruction to a rascal, they'll become angry, and they will, you know, bite you like an envious snake. So, you know, what Srila Prabhupada was doing was very daring. You know, it took the courage it took, you know, at that age to, you know, just drop yourself. So, you know, maybe we tear up a little bit of paper now, we pass everyone a little piece of paper, each one's got their little country, Okay, so whatever you got now, you know, in your bag, whatever possessions you have, everyone will give you a little bit of paper. After class, you can all wander off to a new country and set up a temple. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a, you know, extraordinary amount of courage. And to do that in a world that has no sense of guru, Krishna consciousness or what have you, and very prejudiced of people from other countries. One time, Prabhupada, when he was a young boy, I think it's in the, might be the Leelamrita, I know in one of the lectures he describes it, one of the lectures he was describing that in India they built this very large building, sort of big monument, and it was, you know, some stories up. And while the construction was going on, Prabhupada as a little boy, you know, went up there and he would sort of walk in those very dangerous heights and what have you. And he was telling that story to his disciples, and his disciples, one of his disciples said, "Prabhupada, you were so brave back then." Prabhupada said, "I'm still brave now. Otherwise, how could I come to the West?" So, extraordinary courage, but despite, the potential for failure, loss, death, suffering, humiliation, his devotion to his spiritual master, had given him an instruction. And that became his very life and soul. So he did that. And of course, in that way, you know, Prabhupada came to the West, and really the only tangible asset really was his faith in Guru and faith in Krishna. You know, a chastity. There's no question of, there's not even, you know, the tiniest little thought of not executing the order of his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, at that. It's a great pleasure to actually serve a guru, a spiritual master, someone of Srila Prabhupada's caliber. And of course, Srila Prabhupada, despite the, apart from, I should say, his love for Krishna, his spiritual master, and, his chastity to them, when he preached Krishna consciousness, he was also preaching the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Western world. You know, the Srimad Bhagavatam is, filled with so many different, pastimes and stories, which we accept as fact. You know, every word of the Bhagavatam, we accept every single word as the absolute truth, as fact. We don't take little bits. There are living entities who live on the moon. There are, Gandharvas and Apsaras and, so many different personalities. Of course, the Western people, the Americans have just said they've been to the moon and all they found is dust. And Srila Prabhupada saying, no, actually, according to the Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's a heavenly planet, and all the planets are inhabited with, so many different personalities. He was presenting the Bhagavatam, and there again we see, and presenting the Bhagavad Gita, there again we see Srila Prabhupada's absolute chastity. is not, you know, he would never speak anything that was not there in Shastra or he had not heard from his spiritual master. You know, one time he was talking about different bogus gurus. And of course, you know, there are many. I won't mention the names. But, what's that? No, we won't. But, you know, then he looked at his disciples and he could see, and they may be thinking, oh, he's talking gossip, you know, about this. He said, no, I'm speaking these things because my spiritual master personally told me these things about that guru, that so-called guru. And, you know, otherwise, you know, even sometimes sort of Prabhupada's disciples who, you know, had you know, knowledge of, you know, some misbehavior that goes on in some, you know, so-called spiritual circles, you know, they would tell Prabhupada things, but, you know, he didn't engage in idle gossip, you know, just hearing bad qualities about this guru and that guru like that. You know, if it was coming from, if there was some authoritative statements coming through Shastra, coming through his spiritual master like that, coming through Bhaktivinoda the core, then he would, you know, mention those things because they were authority, you know, there was authority. He wouldn't speak anything without authority. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, he wanted us to, you know, follow that same mood, that as devotees, if there's no authorization from Shastra, Guru, the Acharya, a devotee shouldn't actually speak it if it's something speculative, if they're not sure, if there's no authority. That's the proper chastity to scripture and to the Guru. So Srila Prabhupada also, even in this Vedic culture, you know, if you go back thousands of years, you know, and you talk about Krishna associating with his friends and, you know, associates in Vrindavan, you know, Srila Prabhupada wouldn't be out of place there at all. He'd fit in beautifully because his character is a Vrindavan character. His character is so spotless that in the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he'd just fit in beautifully like that. You know, I'd try to picture myself in Vrindavan. something doesn't fit. You know, so many bad qualities. You know, what's Krishna got over there? You know, he's got more ladders than me. But, you know, Srila Prabhupada, he is just literally the personification of love and compassion and gentleness. You know, he's such a gentleman. And, you know, despite... We see that, of course, a lot of devotees have worked hard over, you know, the last few days. You know, it's hard to imagine how devotees, you know, what they've done. Some of them have had barely any sleep, you know, or hardly anything to eat. You know, back is aching, legs are aching. You know, putting everything aside for Krishna and Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes we know that, you know, when we get a little overtired, a little overworked, we can become a bit snappy, a bit cantankerous, a bit grumpy, you know, a bit critical, you know, like that. It can affect. So, especially if there's a lot of pressure, you know, weighing upon us, that, you know, or, you know, I've got to sweep upstairs, I can't find the broom. It's like, you know, Someone's moved it. Yeah. You know, it's like, how can I function in a place like this? You know. But you imagine Srila Prabhupada, he's got a worldwide movement. Gradually, books are being distributed, and temples are going out, and each and every of those hundreds and hundreds of disciples, thousands gradually, all having to be trained up, each and every one of them wanting personal attention and personal time from Srila Prabhupada. You know, it's like when, you got two or three people want your attention at once, you know, especially if you're tired, you haven't had prasad. Srila Prabhupada's got thousands of devotees, a whole worldwide organization, and he is just so gentle and compassionate and loving, with everyone in all his transactions. You know. It's sometimes Srila Prabhupada's greatness is sometimes a bit elusive to perceive because, if you see someone for a short period of time, they may visit, everyone's always on their best behavior, and then once they're gone, you don't. So every time you see them, but Srila Prabhupada's, his every word is documented practically, his every movement is documented. So, you can add up his whole life and you see that Srila Prabhupada was always the same completely transcendental personality, no matter what was going on in his life. You know, he's very, very kind, very, very compassionate. And although he was, associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he saw each and every person as Krishna's, a spirit soul, ultimately someone who's fallen from the spiritual world. You know, he wasn't so much, looking at them from a material perspective, Oh, here's one of Krishna's children, So he was like Kunti Devi. She's looking after the fatherless children. Kunti Devi is looking after the fatherless children. And the five Pandavas, the father is gone. And, Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra, there are so many people who would want them dead because, they're in line to the throne. And she's not a warrior, a kshatriya, a politician. She's a mother. And she's got to deal with some of the most powerful warriors and kshatriyas and, armies. One woman, five children. Sole parent. So, but she understood that, that was her task. And of course, Kunti Devi devoted herself to that task of, raising the Pandavas and keeping them out of danger. You don't see that quality even in mothers these days. Even mothers, there's some disturbance to one's career or sense of gratification, then they will terminate the child even, within the womb. But Srila Prabhupada was like that, Kunti, that wherever he went in this world, he saw us as fatherless children. They've lost Krishna. They've fallen from Krishna. They don't know. Actually, their father is still there. But they've forgotten him because they're under the grip of Maya. So I will help them to get back to Krishna like that. Sometimes, if you see a child walking around the street, say you see you know, a 3 or 4 year old child walking down the street. They're obviously, you know, not really well looked after because they're just fending themselves. How does a young child fend for themselves? You know, naturally a person becomes compassionate. You don't think, you know, I might help this person, you know, if it depends on their race, their caste, you know, their education, their good qualifications, what can I get out of this? You know, it's just a natural response that you know, here's this young child. You know, it doesn't matter who they are, where they're from. You know, they could be the child of Charles Manson, what have you. You know, it's a young child. You look, you know, just like Prahlad Maharaj. You know, when the demigods wanted to kill Prahlad Maharaj while he's within the womb, because they thought, you know, within this mother's womb is the son of a demon. So we should kill him because he can become very powerful. But Narada Muni said no. He is a devotee. And he took the mother to his ashram and he preached to the mother, and the child heard from within the womb. So Srila Prabhupada saw all of that, all of us like that. Just a very, very compassionate, loving mood. And so he was kind to everyone without any discrimination at all. He just had love, and he could see our plight. And he traveled all over the world. You know, he went to Russia. It didn't matter. He went to Iran. He went to Tehran. You know, he went to, you know, China. And I think he went to China. Did he go to China? Japan. Japan? He went to Japan. Yeah. He went to Japan. He sent him. Yeah. He came to Australia. Fancy preaching in Australia amongst the Aussies. Jamal Krishna was also asked to come to Australia and he declined. He said, I don't think I could preach there. Baba Nanda and Madhavisa kindly came. But, you know, there was no discrimination with Prabhupada. If there's an opportunity to there, he just preached. And Srila Prabhupada still looks upon us with that same kindness and compassion. That whatever little service we can do for Krishna, Srila Prabhupada very kindly accepts that, because he's just trying. We're just like these tiny little babies in spiritual life, you know, and he's trying to get us all the way back to Krishna's lotus feet. Whatever little service we can offer, you know, Srila Prabhupada is accepting. He's not accepting, he's not seeing the fault. Prabhupada said, you know, he has the same mood as Krishna. The Krishna always takes the bright side. There's a cartoon that the children watch now, Ruby Gloom. And they sing, you know, take the bright side of the dark side. Sometimes Rooney sings that. And when I heard her singing that, she goes, what does that mean? And I told her the story about Patana. You know, that Patana, she actually came to kill Krishna. But Srila Prabhupada said, Krishna just took the bright side. That she's offered me the breast milk like a mother. So he rewarded her in that way. Krishna is unlimitedly compassionate and kind. But Srila Prabhupada, Krishna wants to glorify his devotee to be even greater than Krishna. As Krishna wants to, he wants to empower his devotee to be more wonderful and more glorious even than Krishna. That is the relationship with Krishna. And that is the relationship between the guru and the disciple. And this is what is not understood. And people think, you know, you're serving the guru, you're dedicating everything, you know, he's taking everything, you're giving this and that, and, you know, guru's just taking. It's not like that. The guru is thinking that, you know, I am a very, very humble servant of the servant of the servant. I'm just trying to do a little service for my guru. I'm not anyone so wonderful. They are wonderful, but they're not thinking like that. My guru, he is a great personality. I am very, very insignificant. I'm just trying to do whatever little service I can for my guru. That's it. There's some credit in that, otherwise. But that guru, he wants everyone that he meets, China, Russia, this, you know, Africa, that you become the guru. You become the great personality. You become an associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The spiritual master wants everyone in this world to have the opportunity to be the most glorious personality. He wants to raise everyone up. You be glorious. The guru likes to see his disciples, you know, advancing in Krishna consciousness and doing wonderful, wonderful things and going back to the spiritual world. So there's a loving relationship. Actually, when the guru accepts service from the disciples, the guru, there's no personal benefit. He's accepting that service for our benefit. In the same, Krishna says, you surrender unto me. Krishna is the husband of the goddess of fortune. In fact, as we heard yesterday, Krishna in Vrindavan, he has unlimited goddesses of fortune serving his every will. Even personalities like Lord Brahma worship the goddess of fortune for her favor. Even Brahma, even the greatest of demigods, just give the goddess of fortune, give a little favor. And here is Krishna. Those goddesses of fortune, they become in anxiety that maybe Krishna will leave us. So, what do we offer Krishna? What, you know, when he says surrender unto me, it's for our benefit that we become completely spiritualized. We become purified of this miserly, materialistic, you know, mentality. Here I am in the material world. I've got this material body. Let me get so much sense gratification. Let me get so many possessions. Let me get so much fame like this, you know. And whatever I have to do to other people to, you know, make sure I get my fair whack, you know, I will cause this havoc to this one like this. You know, we have these problems. And when we learn to love and to give to Krishna, all of that greed and lust and impurity, it disappears. And the representative, the guru, whatever you offer, he uses in Krishna's service directly. You give him millions of dollars, open a temple here, distribute some books there, distribute some prasadam there, like this. It is for the benefit of the disciple, like that. So, we've very, very fortunate, of course, to have that opportunity to do whatever little service we can to a bona fide guru, spiritual master, someone who's in the line coming from Krishna, giving us the opportunity to go back to the spiritual world, to Krishna Loka, and to associate with a whole spiritual world full of wonderful personalities like Srila Prabhupada, rather than rot here, as Srila Prabhupada says, rather than rot here in the material world. And what is our qualification to be given such an opportunity? We had none. We have none. It's all mercy. All Srila Prabhupada's mercy. All the mercy of Krishna and Prabhupada. We have no qualification. Oh, yes, I'm so deserving. Yes, yeah, yeah. Where's my ticket back to Vrindavan? You know, I've got so many good qualifications and this, that and the other. We have none. It's just been handed to us on a plate. Just like a little lost child walking down the street. What are their qualifications? Someone has taken compassion. Come here, little child. Let me take you back to your father. So let us meditate upon the glories of Srila Prabhupada today a little bit. And I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. Yeah, because oh my Lord, is Preeti still living? She lived only for the sake of her fatherless children. Otherwise, it was impossible for her to live without King Pandu, who was the greatest commander and who alone conquered the four directions simply with the help of a second bow. You know, there's there are different reasons. Of course, one, we get the sense of tragic loss that in one sense, you know, Kunti Devi and the Pandavas, they lost their father who was able to protect them from everything, you know, provide for them and protect them. How immense was his ability to protect them and provide. He could conquer all four directions of the world. That's a nice husband to have. So he was a huge loss. And then we also get the sense that, you know, not only his qualifications, but there was a very strong, you know, relationship between them. So that was also, you know, he was a very, very qualified personality. It's like being a multi-millionaire. You know, if you hear a story about someone who's a multi-billionaire and all of a sudden they lose everything. You know, so it just gives you some sense of, you know, quite a very significant, you know, position, you know, that she has, gotten into, you know, the massive loss of everything that was really, maintaining her existence in one sense. At the same time, Pandu is, you know, being glorified also by Vidura. He was a great personality. So it's the nature of devotees to glorify great personalities. They're not impersonal. And it also gives us a sense that, you know, like Srila Prabhupada, you know, he also lost everything, you know, to the point where he was just literally a penniless person on the street. Then to see what Srila Prabhupada did makes his successes almost inconceivably wonderful. How was that possible? You know, by his devotion, chastity, faithfulness, you know, his wonderful intelligence and beautiful personality. He took 40 rupees. Srila Prabhupada would say, you won't find another person who can do this. You take 40 rupees and you end up with 40 crore. You know, it's like so many millions and millions. So, like that. You know, he said, you find a businessman who can do that. You get 40 rupees. You turn that into, say, you know, $40 million in a short period of time. Here also, we see that with Kunti Devi, from that position of having lost everything, you know, quite a tremendous, almost like she just got nothing. To be a widow in Vedic times is not like being a widow now. You just go down to the Centrelink and, you know, get the pension. To be a widow in Vedic times, you could be really in a lot of trouble. But her sons, with her wonderful motherly skills and devotion to them, conquered, become the greatest glorified personalities possible. So, you know, there is the sense of, you know, from greatness to nothing, to, you know, unlimited glories. And Srila Prabhupada's life was like that as well. You know, he was, you know, he could have been, you know, it mentions in his chart that, you know, he could have, he says this himself, that, you know, they looked at my chart, he could have been wealthy, like, you know, Bila, they have this, you know, well, you know, just unlimitedly wealthy. He was thinking, well, you know, it's there, it should be coming, but Krishna kept smashing it and taking it away. So, you know, he did go from, you know, that down to just nothing. No family, no wife, no sons. He's just on the street by himself, nowhere to live, no money, you know, and from that to spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world, it gives you the sense of accomplishment. You know, it's not like Paka. You know, his father's a multi-trillionaire. His son inherits that, you know. He might lose, you know, 10% of that in the casino, but he's still doing pretty well, so we glorify him. Oh, you're such a great personality. Not like that. So, you know, it just gives that sense of comparison as well, and, you know, glorifying Pandu as well. He's a very wonderful devotee. Mm. Mm. Any other questions or comments? Why did they go to the fire? Well, yes, they did not want to be without their husband. You know, their relationship was you know, it was like, you know, the two parts of the same. You know, they're one. One person in two bodies. It's like, you know, it's like losing your other self. You know, it's a great loss. They couldn't bear to live. It was common. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? People like each other that much. Or, you know, let's put it this way. It's hard to imagine people don't hate each other as much as they do now. You know? Especially husband and wife. You know, most stand-up comedians, you know, their favourite jokes is about their wife or their husband. And people love it. Yeah. They're just constantly putting their... But, you know, there was Vedic culture, you know, it gives you just a little window into the character, the bond, you know, friendship. In Kali Yuga, we say, oh, so-and-so is my friend, but we have no real concept of friendship. Very little in Kali Yuga. A husband and wife, you know, there's very little. You know, there's a little fragment left, you know. But, you know, you don't want to be around at the other end of Kali Yuga. Because at the other end of Kali Yuga, the only relationship between man and woman is that they'll just meet on the streets like animals, they have sex and they go their own way. Child is born, and, you know, and sometimes they'll eat their children. There'll be very little food. You know, they will look at us. Now, with all our problems, you know, with all our Kali Yuga characteristics now, the generations in the future will look at us and they cannot imagine, you know, how we nicely deal with each other as family, wife, children, you know. They will just, you know, it'd be just impossible for them to conceive of, you know, what we're doing. With all our faults, I'll consider that as unbelievable. You know, I still, you know, because I go to a lot of homes with, especially with the Indian community, where, you know, the Vedic culture is, Prabhupada said, it's just under the skin. You give a little scratch and it's just there, you know. And, you know, you go to someone's home and... you know, they've got friends. They've had friends their whole life. You know, and they were friends in India. And they moved over to, you know, together. And they built houses in the same, you know, neighborhood to be together. You know, they're lifelong friends. And, you know, you see the elderly people as well. You know, they're friends. They've known them all their life. The other day, a friend from my past... I said to her, you know, she asked me something. I said, "You're the only person I've met who's a friend of mine from the past. I don't see them, I don't know who they. If I saw them, I wouldn't recognize them. We don't keep contact. You're the only person from my past." Who was, you know, a friend that I've seen in the last, you know, 30-something years. You know, that's normal these days. That is normal, you know. Because, you know, just the way life is. You know, you lose your job. There was one devotee, I forget who he was. He said, "Oh, I've lost my job. They're shipping me out to Ballarat or something. I have to go." I said, "But you tell them the devotees here, they're like your family." You know, I think he tried that. But so he has to go and live in Ballarat. You know, it's for work. You know, people have to, you know, they get a job and the boss, there's no, you know, the boss will give them the sack. You know, profitability's down, out. You know, even though they're raking in millions of dollars, you know. A couple of thousand down, get rid of a couple of workers. Then they have to leave their neighbours and their friends, and they might have to go to the other side or another state, or sometimes another country. And all, you know, Kali Yuga just breaks everything up. All your friendships, all the families, everything is broken up. But you know, I still see amongst the Indian community, you know, they're very, very fortunate. That their relationships still, they just go right through the life, you know, from, you know, they're still friends and what have you. When I went to India, I don't know if they do this now, I haven't been since 1984, but You know, when I got there, I saw all the men walking around the street with holding hands. So what is this? What's happening here? Yeah. You know, and I was like, you know, it was hard for me to look at, because it was, you know, men holding hands. You know, you see little girls about, you know, 5, 6 years old, and they walk around holding hands, you know, because they're like BFF, you know. These are like, they're 19, 20 years old, you know, 30 years old, holding hands. Yeah, walking down the street. Do they still do that? Still, yeah. You know, even in my time, I'm finding that inconceivable, you know. Where I grew up, you know, but, I mean, I had a brother, unfortunately, he passed away. But so I do know what a good friend is. I have something to compare with, but unfortunately he passed away. But where I grew up in Broadmeadows, there's no question of holding hands with anyone on the street. You know, when you walk down the street, you had to calculate, there's a gang here, there's a gang there, there's a gang there. You know, which gang do I think I'll be able to get through today to get to the station or to the shops, like that. And, you know, you were ducking and, you know, people were swinging and, you know, chasing you and what have you. You know, it was a very violent, brutal, hateful, you know, place. And if you showed any sort of affection or friendship, you know, even if you had a girlfriend, you know, you showed some affection, you know, some people would come and beat you up just because you looked happy. I'm trying to censor this so that I'm not shocking you too much. You know, I've seen that, you know, walking, even as a teenager, walking through Swanson Street. You know, guy just standing with his, you know, partner. They just looked happy. Car full of people, you know, guys just got out of the car, you know, stirred him up because he's happy. And then they just beat the living daylights out of him and left him there to pull the blow. Jumped in the car, drove off, you know. So, you know, when I go to India, see, you know, the men hold, I can't conceive of that, you know. And it's very hard for us to conceive of this Vedic culture, you know, just the bond between them. Actually, when devotees become Vaishnavas, that bond should be there, you know, quite significantly, you know, between in the community. It should be there, you know, that's, you'd expect that. You know, when... I think it was Jagannath Das Babaji and one other Babaji met, right? So I think it was Jagannath Das Babaji. They met, and there was another Babaji from Vrindavan. So they hugged each other. They were so happy to see each other. And they rolled around on the ground back and forth for hours. And they embraced each other. I think it was like, you know, the next day or something. You know, they decided if they don't eat and drink, you know, we might lose them. And they had to sort of, Babaji's, you know, you're happy to see each other, you know. That's a Vaishnava. Anyway, we should never be, you know, devotees always, you know, they're very modest about their feelings and emotions. They don't put them on display. But actually, sometimes, you know, the overwhelming love and affection should just break through. Anyway, we'll just leave it there. And, of course, that's called chanting and dancing. Hare Krishna. Jai.